Hello, everyone. Welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, and I'm very happy to welcome for the first time Jamie Fly, the executive director of the Foreign Policy Initiative. Jamie, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So, Jamie, you and your colleague Gary Schmidt recently published a piece in Foreign Affairs, The Case for Regime Change in Iran. It was one of a group of articles that were published in Foreign Affairs. The first was Matthew Kronig's Time to Strike Iran, which called for strikes on Iran's nuclear program, and then a follow-up piece to that by Colin Cowell, responding that now is not the time to strike Iran. And then you and Mr. Schmidt responded with your own argument. Go ahead and just describe the arguments in the piece.
Well, I think our main concern was Matt Kronig's piece advocated essentially a limited strike against Iran's nuclear program. And I think Gary and I shared Matt's sense of urgency about the problem and his frustration that perhaps the sanctions regime does not appear to be having the impact, I think, that we desire of convincing the Iranians to give up their nuclear program. But we had some fundamental questions, I think, about Matt's proposal, mainly because if you conduct a limited military strike, as Matt described, you basically are going to leave behind even several components of the nuclear program. And you're likely, as I think will be the case with almost any strike, you're going to be dealing with all the negative repercussions of a military attack against Iran. And so the argument we were making, well, if it gets to the point where you're willing to take, or the United States is willing to take military action, why not go a step further? And rather than only taking out parts of the nuclear program and allowing the Iranians enough elements of the program that they can reconstitute and perhaps even take further underground, which would necessitate either an additional, certainly additional rounds of economic pressure, but maybe even another military strike several years from now, why not take the military option a step further and target some of the assets, the regime assets that are used by the government to continue the repression of the people and maintain grip on power. Now, at least creating the possibility that there might be an opportunity for kind of a regime change from within in the aftermath of this strike. And so, because obviously I think our argument is that in the long run, we need to be concerned about the nuclear program, but the primary reason to be concerned about the nuclear program is the nature of the current Iranian regime itself. And as long as, even if we take out certain nuclear facilities, as long as that regime remains in power, this is going to continue to be a problem for the international community. And so any actions that don't address that fundamental issue regarding the regime are only going to be half solutions.
So in the piece, in the opening, and you guys write, destabilizing the regime could, in quote, potentially resolve the Iranian nuclear crisis once and for all. And as you just described, your idea is that it could replace the current regime, which is with one that is whatever more friendly or more pliant. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we've seen in many cases, you don't know, as we're seeing with the Arab Spring right now, you don't know exactly what regime would follow. I think in the case of Iran, though, it's difficult to envision a regime that could be worse than the current one. And as we saw play out in recent years, there is an opposition movement. It's been repressed. But that's in large part, I think, also because we in the United States and other allied countries are not doing enough to support the opposition. But I find it hard to believe that any regime that would follow this one would not want to, as a first matter of priority, sit down with the international community and get rid of this nuclear problem that's hanging over their heads. Because obviously, if they some sort of follow-on regime was swept into power by people in the streets, most likely they are not going to want to have the international sanctions continue. They're going to want to improve the economy and take actions that are going to immediately benefit the Iranian people. And I think, as someone who's skeptical of this regime's willingness to negotiate, I do think a follow-on regime, most likely led by democratic opposition leaders, would be willing to negotiate away most, if not all, of the nuclear program.
So on that, how would you respond? I mean, speaking of democratic opposition leaders, Mir Hussein Mousavi, who himself was one, along with Rafsanjani, was one of the kind of godfathers of restarting Iran's nuclear program back in the 80s. He's one of the figureheads of the current Green Movement. He's been under house arrest for some months now. I think there are genuine, legitimate questions over how much of a leadership role he's actually playing, but he is serving as a kind of figurehead for this movement. I mean, he was one of the leading critics of the Tehran research reactor deal that Ahmadinejad supported back in 2009. So how does that square with the idea that a new democratic opposition leader leading the new Iran would be willing to forego or give up Iran's nuclear program?
I think certainly there's long been an element of national pride in Iran's nuclear program, but we need to remember that that is in part because the regime has always couched, in most cases, I mean, a few times they slip up here and there, but in most cases they couch the rhetoric about the nuclear program as their right to a civilian nuclear program and their right to enrich, which they do have under the NPT as long as they're abiding by the NPT. And so the core issue in terms of whether I think the United States and our allies and the international community writ large could accept an Iran that has an enrichment capability, for instance, would come to whether we could resolve all of the concerns about their covert weaponization work about all the areas where they violated their commitments, which the current regime denies, which, like the International Atomic Energy Agency, have shown that the Iranians were carrying out a variety of activities that violated these commitments. And so, again, will Iranians writ large want to give up nuclear power, or many of them perhaps even the right to enrich? I don't know. But I would have more trust and faith in their ability to negotiate in good faith than I do the current regime. And I think likely they would perhaps be willing to give up and release information about what the previous regime was doing on the nuclear weapons side. I do think there's been a shift, perhaps, if it ever was the case that the Iranian people writ large are interested in nuclear weapons. I think you just need to talk to Iranian opposition figures and a number of dissidents. And I think a lot of them have looked at the toll that this program has brought upon the economic toll brought upon the country by this program, by the regime's willingness to kind of put the program even behind, even above the interests of the people. And post June 2009 and the repression, I just think the regime, partly because of its obstinance about the nuclear program, probably has undermined the case for a nuclear weapon in the eyes of a lot of Iranians.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think it's very difficult to know how to treat polling information out of Iran. I think one should definitely be skeptical. Certainly of polling that's done via phone from outside the country. I think there are other polls that have been done, you know, first person. But I think just taking a lot of these polls, you know, taking them all together, I think one can sort of discern a fairly strong support among Iranians for Iran's right to a peaceful nuclear program, a civilian nuclear program, a right to domestic enrichment. I think support for Iran's a nuclear weapon is much, much smaller. And again, I mean, I just want to be very careful about saying any of this for certain, but that's what I seem to gather if looking at, you know, the kind of array of polling that's been done on Iran. But one thing I have heard myself from conversations with Iranian dissidents is that the intense focus, and this is kind of where I is in some tension with what you and Gary assert in your piece, is that there has been a mistake made by the P5+1, by the Obama administration, to focus so intensely on the nuclear program at the expense of other issues like human rights. Because unlike human rights, which is where the regime is really vulnerable, you know, given that they represent themselves as a just Islamic government, their continued human rights abuses are a kind of soft spot and a chink in that claim. The nuclear program, according to dissidents I've spoken to, they feel the regime feels that it's on fairly safe ground in continuing to assert Iran's rights to a nuclear program, and I gather that you don't quite agree with that.
No, I mean, like you said, it's hard to find reliable polling, and it's hard from an outsider's perspective to judge exactly. My guess is, though, given what we hear about the state of the Iranian economy, I don't think that your average Iranian today likely blames the United States or Europe for the current economic mess, and I think there's probably more blame and more unrest directed towards the government. And if that's the case, then they must realize that it's because of the government's insistence on plodding forward on the nuclear program and not being willing to compromise or even sit down. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you mentioned the Tehran Research Reactor deal or partial deal, but since then, which I think was in late 2009, we haven't even really had serious talks. I mean, there were talks in Turkey at one point, but the regime doesn't even seem bothered enough to sit across the table, even with an administration, in this case the U.S. administration, that's willing to send emissaries to talk to them, along with the Europeans and the Russians and Chinese. Mm-hmm. And so if I were an Iranian, I don't think you can even see your government trying to negotiate in good faith to remove these crippling sanctions and relieve the burden that is being placed on the country.
So, I mean, getting, you know, this idea, I mean, and this, I mean, what you just said, I think it makes sense, but at the end of the day, it is really conjecture. And this gets at, you know, some of the concern that I had with the piece. If one is going to say, okay, then we can carry these strikes out and weaken the regime such that it no longer has control over its own people or no longer has the ability to control its people, whatever, you know, basically ceases to be a functioning state. In a situation like that, where we have, you know, you're talking about basically state collapse, it seems like very, very, you know, you're kind of just wishing that what comes after that is something better. I mean, what is to say that the regime that comes after that, especially given the fact that they've just been bombed by the country that they've been vilifying for 30 years, what is to say that the regime that comes next isn't even worse?
Yeah, I guess the question in response, though, then, is so what would you propose? Would you propose the limited military strike advocated for by Matt Kronig, or would you support Colin Call's assertion that now is not the time for military action, we have plenty of time to pursue other options?
Well, no, I mean, I'm happy to get to that. But I do think that if one is going to kind of propose this sort of expansive military action to basically destroy a state, which I think the consequences of which have been discussed very widely by both civilian and military analysts, and they are severe, I think if one is going to propose that, then I think, you know, the onus is sort of on you to describe, okay, what's your evidence that, you know, it's going to turn out as you suggest. I just don't see, I mean, I'm trying to think of examples in recent history or even human history where people, you know, people have been attacked And, you know, no matter how vicious or horrible their government is, and granted, the Iranian regime is very, very bad and abusive. It's, you know, no question there. But I'm just trying to think of examples of when a people have been attacked by an outside power and have responded by siding with that power against their own government. I'm having a hard time coming up with any.
Well, I mean, I don't think Gary and I wrote at all about attacking the Iranian people. I mean, we were pretty clear, I think, we didn't outline point by point which sites to strike or anything like that. But once you move beyond the set of nuclear targets, what we were advocating was taking out installations connected to regime leadership, the intelligence ministry, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now, obviously, our military targeting is not always perfect, and there would be some civilian casualties. But I think this could be done in a way that this would not be seen as an operation targeted against the Iranian people. And certainly, if it was perceived that way, it would be incredibly problematic in terms of what any follow-on government and what their posture would be towards the United States or anyone else involved in this military operation. I think part of it, though, too, Matt, is I think a lot of us look at Iran, and it's not the concern about whether a follow-on government would be better. It's not just whether they would want nuclear power or a nuclear weapon. There are also obviously broader concerns the United States has always had in recent decades about Iran's activities in its neighborhood, about its support for terrorism, about its more recent killing of American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that is also why I think Gary and I advocated that any military action, if it came to that, should be expanded beyond the nuclear program, because there's no reason not to go after arms depots that the IRGC has used to support and supply Shiite militias in Iraq, or bases in Iran that are being used to provide lethal aid to the Taliban that are killing Americans in Afghanistan. And so I think we have a broader set of concerns with Iran. And again, when you add up that full spectrum of issues, and I haven't even right now mentioned, obviously, Iran's repression of its people, I find it just, I really can't imagine that any follow-on regime could be more brutal to its own people or could be more hostile to American interests than the current one.
I mean, there have been, first let me just go back to, you know, what you said about striking Revolutionary Guard facilities and intelligence ministries, etc. At this point, we're talking about strikes in downtown Tehran. And then we are talking about civilian casualties, very significant civilian casualties. It just comes back, I have a very difficult time imagining a scenario in which the Iranian people respond to this by saying, you know what, the Americans are right, let's overthrow this government. That's not to say that they don't dislike this government. I'm sure many of them do. I think there are questions over, you know, how far they'd be willing to go. But I have just serious questions. I mean, in your piece, you write that, quote, if anything, Iranian nationalism and pride would stoke even more anger at the current regime. I mean, yes, this is nationalism and pride that has been stoked against the very power that is bombing them. I mean, you guys mentioned, you quote Iranian activist Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winning human rights lawyer. I mean, I interviewed her 2 years ago, and she was adamant that we should stop talking about striking Iran, and that she said, if America strikes Iran, the Iranian people will resist, and I will join them. I mean, it seems significant that a Nobel Peace Prize winning activist has promised that she would join the anti-American resistance if there were an attack, doesn't it?
I think that, I mean, my understanding is even her views, for instance, and the quote we cited was her views in the larger context of the interview she gave with the Wall Street Journal was about her views on the nuclear program shifting over time, and she was saying she thought a lot of other Iranians felt the same way. I think you see the same thing with a lot of Iranian opposition figures, too. You have seen views shift, or starting to shift about military action. So I don't know, in her case, whether it's on the actual question of military action, whether it's shifted or not. But I do think as the inability of the Green Movement to really get back on its feet has occurred, it's probably caused some in the Iranian opposition to perhaps rethink whether or not they support more outside direct intervention. Your question of targeting, I mean, if I recall, I think in the 90s, during our intervention in the Balkans and the Kosovo war, we took out some leadership command and control assets, including in downtown Belgrade. And there are plenty of ways to conduct those operations at night or at other times on the weekends when, you know, people are certainly not even in, the workers are not in the building. I don't think we can always assume that every major Iranian headquarters or command facility is in the middle of an apartment block. And so I think there are plenty of sites that we could go after that could really undermine the regime's ability to maintain its grip on power without a significant number of civilian casualties.
I mean, I'm unaware of any Iranian dissidents that have called for or supported American military action. If there are some, if you know of some, I mean, please share. I don't know of any. The ones that I've spoken to have been uniformly against it, both just for reasons of national pride and because they feel very strongly that that would provide the Iranian government precisely the pretext it wants for just a massive purge. Now, I think it's a fair question to say, well, how much worse can the government be? And I think we would find out. But I think this goes to the problem that I mentioned earlier is that this is, I mean, for something that would have enormous consequences for U.S. policy in the region, this seems like a serious amount of conjecture and assuming that a use of military power could create positive outcomes. And this is coming after, you know, the Iraq War, when we saw, you know, we saw a lot of claims of a similar nature saying, you know what, we can do it, it'll be whatever, a cakewalk, it'll be this, it'll be that, and it didn't work out that way. I mean, at the very least, we have to understand that this sort of military action on this scale produces unintended consequences that we simply cannot foresee. And before we undertake something like that, it seems to me that we have to have a much, much better idea of what could come after than is presented here.
Well, I think the issue then goes back to what is your proposed strategy, because a lot of the concerns that you raise, I agree with some of them as potential outcomes of the more limited strike that Matt Kronig advocates. But my concern, part of the reason I think why we proposed expanding and going beyond that is because we think that the limited strike option is fundamentally flawed or creates a certain dangerous potential for a very dangerous, uncertain environment in the aftermath. I do think that if you just hit some nuclear facilities, essentially, and the other problem with Kronig's argument is that he actually, in an attempt to limit the Iranian response, says that we should send messages to the regime that we're not actually trying to remove them from power. And in that case, we're basically justifying and supporting the regime's existence, which I think is just bad policy generally. And if, again, the Iranian people see us not even targeting any aspects or elements of the regime that are helping to suppress them on a daily basis, I think you might provoke some sort of negative response. But I think I fundamentally just disagree with this notion that just by carrying out a military action which targets regime elements that we're automatically going to turn the entire country against us. I don't think that's correct. I think given the saga we've gone through in recent years with Iran, I think the Iranian people understand what this is about and who's responsible for their current plight, and they realize it's not the United States.
And what's UK. Your evidence for that?
I think it's clear in terms of we had opposition figures in June 2009 on the streets of Iran pleading for external assistance and moral support and not getting it from this administration. You interact with a lot of dissidents, I'm sure, and you talk to dissidents who have fled the country. They want more international involvement, not less. I think the Iranian people, your average Iranians, I think, are incredibly pro-American and pro-Western. They are not in line with this regime's anti-Western views. And so, again, I think it all goes back. I think we're likely headed is if you're not willing to take action, military action at all, and you're willing to contain a nuclear Iran, then some of these things perhaps you can really argue about the repercussions of a military strike versus what a world with a nuclear Iran would look like, which I really think is which leads a lot of us to actually be looking at potential military action, because I think there's and this is where I agree with Matt Kronig, is that if you look at what it would take to contain a nuclear Iran, what the regional implications would be, what the long-term implications would be for American interests, I think you have to come to the conclusion that if your choice is do nothing and accept a nuclear Iran, or the other alternative is take military action, I think in the end this administration is likely going to choose military action over containment.
Let me get to that in a second. Just quickly on the question of Iranian dissidents, I have spoken to quite a few of them, and some of them, I think there is a diversity of views. As you said, some of them were in the streets calling on Obama, you know, asking, where are you, Obama? Are you with them or with us? I think many that I've spoken to, including Shirin Ebadi, who, when I straight up asked her whether she thought Obama should have come out more vocally on the side of the Green Movement, kind of responded, you know, somewhat almost as if that were insulting. She was like, this is the movement of the Iranian people. We're not depending on anyone's help. This is our movement, and this is for us to achieve. Now, you know, she is one person, but I think that's a sentiment that I would assume that a lot of people might share. But again, I think it's not uniform by any means. But what I would say is that I think Iranian nationalism, like any nationalism, is complex. And yes, Iranians are notable in that they're not completely anti-American. They were they did hold a pro-American vigil on 9/11. That a lot of people don't remember that. But still, just the idea that they would respond to America bombing their country by siding with America, that just kind of staggers me. I don't know of any historical examples that one can clearly look to support that. On the question of the Obama policy, I think they've shown and told us in various ways, in various times, consistently that military action against Iran, even though it's on the table and they have a contingency plan, as the U.S. military has contingency plans for all kinds of things, they're not interested in this. And that's very understandable, because, part of explaining why is having, you know, current and former military people coming out and talking about what the consequences of a U.S. strike on Iran would actually entail, not only in Iran, but across the region, and at a very, very sensitive time in the Middle East transition, the Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening, as I usually prefer to call it, that could go, still go in a number of different ways. And I think a strike, another attack by the United States on a Muslim country, even though people in the Arab world are not crazy about Iran by any means, I think an attack by the United States on Iran could do a lot to marginalize the United States even further at a very critical time in what I very much hope will be a democratic transition.
So, Matt, are you saying that you think the administration is not interested in this now in 2012, or they're never going to be interested in a military strike?
No, I think what they're saying, I mean, listen to what they're saying. They're saying that a nuclear, Iranian nuclear weapon is unacceptable. So I'm more, you know, I'm open to the idea that if Iran, if there were evidence that Iran was about to break out and obtain a weapon, but various administration officials, including Panetta and DNI Clapper, have said that there's no evidence as yet that they have made that decision. But I think we should distinguish between a capability and a weapon. I know that's a distinction that a lot of people don't want to grant. But I do think it's an important one. So, yes, and a nuclear weapons-capable Iran is not a great state of affairs. It's by no means optimal. But I think we've been seeing the creation of a pretty strong containment regime in place, working with various allies, including Turkey. The placement of a NATO radar system in Turkey was a big part of this, and that has enraged Iran. But I think it's sent a very important message both to Iran and to the region. I think it was a great move on the part of Turkey, and congratulations to the Obama administration for working so closely with Turkey to do that. But I think what it gets down to is that even though a nuclear-capable Iran is a bad situation to have to deal with, the very, very likely costs of a military strike by the United States on Iran and what it could actually achieve, and many don't believe that it could destroy the nuclear weapons program, it could set it back, and we can talk about whether that's how beneficial that actually is, but the costs of doing that really just don't make sense.
And I understand that point of view. I mean, a couple of things to respond to there. My understanding or my sense is, though, that what you just outlined goes a bit beyond where the administration is, because I think they're very careful, and I don't think there's clear consensus within the U.S. government that a nuclear Iran, I think as you put it, would be a bad thing, but somehow it's something that we could deal with, or that a nuclear Iran might actually be better than the repercussions from a military strike. I think the issue, as you mentioned towards the beginning of your comment, is that the administration thinks they have time right now, and that mm-hmm. you see that in the statements by Panetta and Clapper. They think that this is a 2013 problem at the mm-hmm. earliest, not a 2012 problem. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's where we have these slightly different timelines with the Israelis, because mm-hmm. they don't have a 2013 option, and they see their option expiring in 2012. So I think the administration thinks they still have time. I would find it incredibly hard to believe if they re-elected Barack Obama, who tried to at least devote a significant amount of time during the first several years of his administration to his vision of a world without nuclear weapons, allows Iran to develop nuclear weapons on his watch. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just how Iran would react and whether we can deter Iran, there will be a cascade of proliferation unseen before in the history of nuclear weapons. We will have a multipolar nuclear Middle East, mm-hmm. and we are not going to be in a position to manage that effectively without certainly conventional, I think, conflicts kind of on the margins of that situation. And when you have that many nuclear powers in a relatively small area, the risk of some sort of miscalculation, an escalation between countries that have just acquired nuclear weapons that may not have already installed and set up the appropriate protocols and safeguards for command and control of those weapons. You could have more of a concern about terrorists getting their hands on nuclear weapons from some of these new nuclear weapon states, or even them being used against each other. I just think if you just play that out and war game that whole scenario, I don't see how that looks any – certainly, I just don't even see how that looks any better than the aftermath of a military strike on Iran. And I think that's what the administration will face if they're correct that this is really a 2013 issue, which I, as someone who spent 4 years in government working on nonproliferation, have some fundamental questions about how our intelligence community is assessing Iran's capabilities. So I'm not even convinced that they're correct in that assessment. But if they're correct, and this is something that really needs to be focused on in 2013, I think when they are faced with that decision, and my guess is any president when faced with that decision is still going to decide to take military action of some sort. And then that's where I think the kind of debate between Matt Kronig and Gary Schmidt might come into play, because if you look at the various military options, there are obviously downsides to different types of options. There's a downside to the Israeli option of doing it in the next several months, because the Israeli capabilities are much more limited, and the diplomatic fallout, I would argue, is obviously going to be greater, and the remnants of the program left behind are going to be much more significant than if the U.S. took mm-hmm. action.
Right, no, I think you're right about what the administration's plan is. It is to just extend, just put more time on the clock using various methods to do that. But when you talk about the aftermath of an Iranian nuclear capability, the nuclear cascade, I mean, yes, I think that's a concern. I would also note that I think these sorts of cascades have been predicted for many years by nuclear experts. We have yet to really see one. I don't think that means we should just dismiss that possibility. I do think it's one to really think seriously about. But I would also say, I mean, I think various military experts, I think former Joint Chiefs Chairman Mullen also said, and others, that, okay, you strike Iran, you set back their program, you destroy significant elements of it, but then you get it, but then, you know, they redouble their efforts, and that's where you are again.
No, I agree with that, and that's why we tried to lay out a case for not just a targeted, a limited strike, but to go well beyond that and get rid of the regime and at least create the conditions that will allow the regime, the people of Iran, to rise up and change the regime.
So it just, you know, you've had a former Joint Chiefs Chairman Mullen and many others talking about the what can military strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities actually accomplish, and you might get a delay, but you also get an Iranian regime that is redoubling its efforts on the nuclear front, and so then you've got all the costs of a strike on Iran, international outrage, strikes by Iran's allies, plus the potential nuclear proliferation problem that you were originally trying to avoid.
No, I share those concerns about the impact of a limited strike, which is why I think Gary and I were advocating going beyond that, because we felt that if you at least can start to create conditions for by going after regime leadership elements and command and control, you create the condition for getting rid of the regime. In a limited strike, especially one as limited as that outlined by Matt Kronick, you're basically telling the regime, we're only going to hit these few nuclear sites, we're not going to touch you at all, and you're leaving them there and basically feeling somewhat threatened because at least part of their program was destroyed, and I think that's right, that they would probably be driven underground. Kronick actually writes about leaving certain elements of the program off the target list to keep it very narrow and to minimize the amount of time required. And as soon as you do that, you create some real problems, like you said, because you're leaving behind pieces that can be reconstituted. Perhaps very quickly, and also the other concern you have to have with anything that's really just aiming at the program itself is you're kind of basing your targeting obviously on what intelligence we have about known facilities, but you have to assume that there are covert sites that we know or we may know nothing about, and obviously we can't target them if we don't even know they exist. And at this point, I think the Iranians would have to be pretty stupid to, especially after sites like Qom. I mean, Natanz originally was meant to be a secret facility. We get word of these sites, they've been exposed, the IEA is monitoring them. I think it makes a lot of sense the Iranians must have some sort of, at least a pilot, small enrichment facility somewhere that would allow them to quickly reconstitute their abilities after a strike, which again, it gives back to, you need, in the medium term, you need to get rid of the regime to solve this problem.
Well, right, I mean, so even if you do a broader strike, as you and Schmidt advocate, you still have the problem of secret sites that we don't even know about. So it comes back to the issue as we discussed earlier, of just what's the likelihood that you end up with a regime that's better than this one, and that makes different calculations on the nuclear program. And as you said, I think your position is that what could be worse, and I actually have not much problem imagining one that could be worse, but I guess we'll just have to kind of disagree there. So I think we've reached the end. I really appreciate the time. It was a really interesting discussion. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
All right, well, I look forward to doing it again. Have a great day.
Great.